On this episode of Newt's World, the American Legislative Exchange Council just released the 14th edition of Rich States, Poor States, the Alec Laffer State Economic Competitiveness Index, its newest publication in an annual series illustrating each state's competitiveness and economic outlook using 15 equally weighted policy variables and trends from past decades. The new edition finds that even through the pandemic, states with policies such as low or no income tax and worker freedom are more economically competitive and better positioned for wage growth, job creation, and domestic in-migration compared to states with higher taxes and higher government spending. The new rankings also reveal that, as proven by the new 2020 census data, Americans vote with their feet by moving from high tax to low tax states. Here, to give a briefing on the latest report, I'm pleased to welcome my guest, Jonathan Williams. Jonathan is the chief economist and executive vice president of policy at the American Legislative Exchange Council. We're very fortunate because we have as a guest today Jonathan Williams, who is the chief economist and executive vice president of policy at the American Legislative Exchange Council. Jonathan founded the Alec Center for State Fiscal Reform in 2011, and he's one of the leading experts in the country on the difference between state policies and state outcomes. So it was interesting, particularly appropriate right now, because you just had the biggest jump in the core inflation index since 1982. You had a dramatic miss on projected new jobs. Instead of about 1 million, which was the economist projection, they actually only added about 66,000. There's a series of things going on here that will shape America's future. And it, to me, is fascinating. Even with all the empirical evidence that's available about what works and what fails, the American left is deeply committed to failing and adopting policies that fail. Jonathan, we're delighted to have you with us. How do you assess the current general situation? And then let's talk about specific states and the lessons from them.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. It's a pleasure to join you. And I'm really glad, let me say, that you're doing this show. I just had the opportunity to listen to your interview with Scott Walker recently, one of our fine ALEC alumnus members, who is a real reform-minded leader and a governor who moved a very difficult state in the right direction tremendously. And I'll tell you what, in general, I am so optimistic right now, even though I think those of us who believe in free market ideas like we do at ALEC are discouraged, clearly, what's happening in Washington with the big government policies. And now we're seeing the results of that. And we racked up the national credit card to now $28 trillion plus. We're seeing the inflation numbers, as you mentioned, that are very discouraging. We're hearing discussions about reversing so many of the positive trends from the Trump tax relief, along with so many other things that we had accomplished in the last several years in Washington. But I remain an optimist because of the concept that you just mentioned, which is a quintessential American concept straight from the founders of these laboratories of competition that are meant to work this way. And states, when they compete with each other, it really does create a market. And when anybody competes with each other, whether it's a business or in this case states that we'll talk about today, it's consumers, in this case taxpayers, who win, and it's freedom that wins. And that's why I remain so optimistic, because we are seeing really some great results at the state level. And whether you kind of group the big states, even if you take America's four largest states and you compare the philosophy of if it moves, tax it; if it keeps moving, regulate it; if it stops moving, subsidize it, the famous line from Reagan, you know, that's the philosophy that Sacramento and Albany and big states like California, New York and Illinois have adopted now for years. And it's clearly failing, because it's not just our opinion here, Mr. Speaker. It is the actual revealed preferences of Americans as they continue to, as we say, vote with their feet away from these big government high tax policies in states like that. And where are they going? They're going to states that value economic competition, free markets, lower taxes, and freedom. States like Texas and Florida, two of the biggest states, of course, that go completely without a personal income tax, as you know well. So what we're seeing play out in in front of us, in front of our eyes every single year. And it's just highlighted and punctuated right now because of the new U.S. Census numbers. And of course, once every decade, Washington does essentially pay attention to what's happening at the state level, because state legislators will redraw their congressional lines in the U.S. House because of reapportionment and then redistricting. And these census numbers tell exactly this story, is the states that are gaining population and now gaining political power as a result, like Texas and Florida and so many of the others that we'll talk about, are the states that take this free market competition to heart.
It is kind of interesting that you have California, Texas, Florida, and New York, which has been an amazing decline for New York over the last half century. So it's hard for people to realize how big New York City was and how big New York was. And the politics of America, say, in 1944 when Roosevelt ran for the fourth time, and how much it has shrunk compared to the rest of the country. California, of course, exploded with growth, but it now for the first time is losing a seat because of the census. And Texas and Florida just keep growing. Florida's been amazingly successful at attracting people, maybe to a point where a lot of native Floridians wonder, do we really need all of these people? But you can put those four states together, and you have a very clear distinction between what's going on with the sort of the liberal states, the high tax, big government, and generally speaking, big government union states, and what's going on with the entrepreneurial, smaller government, lower tax, much less unionized states. Do you find when you look at all 50 states that that pattern continues to play out?
Well, it absolutely does. I mean, you described it perfectly. This is something that is not a recent phenomenon. You correctly note, you know, New York has been hemorrhaging opportunity and people and businesses as a result for decades now. I know you'll appreciate this as a student of history, is you go back to, let's say, the census of 1940 in New York, remarkably, and this would be really surprising to most Americans, New York had 45 representatives in the U.S. Congress, in the House. Now they will be down to 26 after this census, after losing another congressional seat. Just an incredible outmigration, the political loss, certainly that represents just the overall and more damaging economic loss to the state of New York over that time frame. And then the other really huge takeaway that the mainstream media has largely ignored so far is the point that you made, which is for the very first time since statehood in 1850, California will lose the U.S. House district because of this outmigration. And these are huge stories. They should be told time and time again. And it'll remain to be seen if people connect the dots as to why this is happening and the big government policies. And I think that's why shows like this are so important for people to kind of go beyond that headline and kind of start to ask the questions, is what is the common factor here? And of course, now Americans are more mobile than ever because of the pandemic, because employers are giving more flexibility around where individuals may work. And that's a great thing for individuals and families, I think. And as a result, I think if anything, you're going to see an uptick in this migration effect and people leaving high tax states and going to states with more economic opportunity, lower costs of living, and higher quality of living as a result.
I would say of all 50 states, the one which has surprised me the most with its rate of decay is Illinois. The disaster of their pension funds, the effect of machine politics in the state capital of Springfield. Have you looked much at Illinois? It seems to me it has declined at a rate faster than most of the other declining states, if that makes any sense as a concept.
It sure has. And being a Midwesterner myself, I'm a Michigan native, Mr. Speaker. And so I've watched this closely. And as I often travel to the Midwest and put together events for our ALEC legislators in their state capitals around rich states, poor states, and our rankings, I often talk about Illinois as their best economic development partner in the states surrounding it, because it absolutely has spun off the individuals and the jobs to so many of the other states in the Midwest. I will say, you know, it could be slightly worse in that voters, I think, dodged a major bullet this last November when they rejected the so-called progressive income tax that would have dramatically raised the personal income tax. As you know, they've had a flat tax, at least in their state constitution, since they adopted a personal income tax back in the 1960s. And that has been one of the only redeeming factors of a state that has really gone amok And you mentioned one of the biggest problems that they've had is these hundreds of billions of dollars of unfunded public pension liabilities that have completely drained the state coffers, have caused tax burdens and especially property taxes to go up in Illinois. And then, you know, when we talk about the horrible and failed idea of this, some of the states coming to Washington with their hands out and advocating for a federal bailout, and the kind of danger that presents in terms of the principle of federalism and state autonomy, Illinois was front at the line because they absolutely are going to have an insurmountable issue now because of the influence and the probably outsized influence, it's safe to say, of the public employee unions that have driven that state to the brink of bankruptcy. And one of the things that a lot of people forget about and how damaging this kind of policy in Illinois has been is it's not just because of the tax burden, it's actually because now at this point, the pension liabilities are so large that just making kind of the minimum payment as you would on a credit card and like they've done on their pension system for far too long, even that has begun to drain resources away from other core functions of state government, for instance, like roads and bridges and infrastructure and also even public education. There was a stat that even as somebody who follows this day in, day out, shocked me that I saw from the Illinois Policy Institute that something like 90% of all new dollars going to education statewide in Illinois over the last 5 years have gone to pay down their pension debt and their pension costs. They don't go to teacher salaries, they don't go to textbooks, all the things that we're told that we need to pay more taxes to fund education. They're not going there in Illinois because they've made these huge mistakes at the behest of the public employee unions, and they've really messed up what would have been otherwise a powerhouse economy.
When you look at all this, you're going to have continued decay. But I don't know of any state, of the states that are getting poorer, I don't know of any of them that have actually made the breakthrough. As you said, I guess you could argue that Scott Walker in Wisconsin genuinely changed the state in a way that was pretty remarkable and was a real war. I mean, there were people occupying the Capitol for months, which didn't seem to bother the national media. And there were actually death threats to Scott and his family. But with the exception of Wisconsin, do you know of any of these states that has moved away from a high tax, big unionized bureaucracy model, or are they stuck there even as they decay?
Well, I'll tell you, my home state, Michigan, had done some really incredible things over the last decade because of really our single state recession from the economic downturn in 2001. Because of the 9/11 tragedy and the resulting downturn, all the way to 2010, as the rest of America recovered pre-financial crisis, Michigan had double-digit unemployment that entire decade under Jennifer Granholm and her failed policies of high taxes and big government. And of course, she was very big into both public and private sector unionism across Michigan. And in 2010, as many of our graduates from University of Michigan and other fine institutions were leaving to go to Texas, we were educating the workforce of Texas and Florida and Tennessee and the states that just get it right. And we saw so much of this out-migration that, of course, had a different leadership be elected in 2010. You had Governor Rick Snyder come in and replace Jennifer Granholm in the governor's mansion. You had new free market conservative majorities in both houses of the legislature. And they said enough is enough. The definition of insanity is continuing to do what you've always done and having it fail over and over. And that was what the Michigan scenario had been with the autos that had been, you know, outsourced in many cases because of bad federal policies as well and because of global dynamics, as you know well, Newt. But then Michigan did turn it around. We became a right-to-work state. We cut business and personal taxes, and Michigan has become dramatically more competitive as a result. And we've actually seen in-migration and job growth that would have been unthinkable. Thank you to the Trump tax reform, by the way, for reducing business taxes federally that really put Michigan back in the game for a lot of that manufacturing. But we've actually had a scenario now where we've had the manufacturing be insourced to Michigan from Mexico because of the federal change in policies and because Michigan becoming a right-to-work state and lowering taxes. So it can be done, and I think Michigan's a perfect example of that.
And yet, despite all that, you may have one of the two or three worst governors in the country.
We do. We regressed, unfortunately. You know, we had a very good 8-year run there with Governor Snyder and conservatives in the legislature. And unfortunately, 2018 was a very bad year for conservatives in Michigan, as it was in many states. And so, you know, maybe this will be a short-term blip, let's hope, on the radar, Newt.
As you develop your rankings and you actually go through and sort of share from best to worst, walk us through, what are you evaluating in a state to build its ranking?
Great question. In our Rich States, Poor States Index, now that we've had for 14 years, we've kept a consistent time series, which we thought has been important. So you can compare apples to apples year over year and actually check progress or lack of progress, as we've been talking about. But these are variables that my co-author, Art Laffer, your friend, and Stephen Moore developed with us now for a period of decades that they've tracked. And we look at 15 different things, public policy choices that we equally weight, everything in the broad categories, taxes and regulation and labor policy. While it could be truly said that you could choose 1,000 variables that matter for why some states grow and some states don't, we really focused on these 15 for a couple of reasons. And that one, we know based on the theory and the practice that these are some of the most important things that differentiate a state competitiveness versus another state. And tax rates and right to work status and whether a state has a death tax and what the cost of workers' compensation or minimum wages, for instance, are some of the variables. And then just as importantly, though, because there's just so many indices out there and how, you know, this inherent ranking of states gets a lot of good media attention. So lots of groups have jumped into this fray. Unfortunately, some of the other rankings that you see out there are things that measure weather and other things that state legislators, let's say, have very little or zero control over in their state capital. And so we concentrate on actual public policy choices that the men and women who serve in America's state legislators can directly control and change on a pretty short turnaround if they look to make their state more competitive, for instance.
As you look at states that are more competitive, you indicate in your analysis that Utah has been at the top of the ratings in every single edition.
That's exactly right. And it's an incredible accomplishment, you know, 14 years at the top when it's a competitive group at that top place there. And Utah has so many things right. Our ALEC national chairman for 2021 is the Senate President Stuart Adams. And he tells the story, I think, very well in that, you know, Utah, they aren't necessarily the flashiest. Let's say they still have an income tax and they have other factors that maybe other states do slightly better than Utah. However, they've been very consistent and prudent in terms of overall governance, keeping spending limited. If they have a budget shortfall, let's say, like many states were afraid in the last year with the unprecedented nature of the lockdowns in many cases and the contraction of the economy, we were all thinking, you know, it could be very acute. Well, Utah did not go back to the taxpayers like many inclinations of those governors in the high tax states, like Andrew Cuomo and Phil Murphy in New York and New Jersey, for instance. You know, Utah always tries to live within their means, and I think they've proved that out. But a couple of the innovative things that I think they've been way ahead of the curve on some of the public policy choices that many states would be wise to see. And this is the issue we just talked about in Illinois, for instance, about a decade ago, when many states still thought their pension funds had no problems and that this failed kind of old school defined benefit model that only exists for public employee unions now today. As the private sector several decades ago has moved to the 401k flexible model for young employees, let's say, Utah got ahead of that curve a decade ago and transitioned new employees to more of a hybrid 401k style model that has really saved the state billions in unfunded liabilities that would have otherwise accrued. And so that's just one example. Another one, which I think is really important too, is this issue of property taxes. One of the most hated taxes in America, but Utah now for 30 years has it on their books in a way that has limited property taxes by really putting taxpayers in charge to say, local units of government, if you want to take more property tax collections and rising house values right now, one of the big issues, Newt, is that local governments love to take the assessment increases and they are not very honest about it sometimes, and that they take the collections, they tell you they've just reduced your property taxes, but you're wondering why you paid more this year than you did last year. It's because the assessments of your house went up more than the rate went down. So to get to the heart of that property tax game, Utah has now said, local units of government, if you want to take more property taxes from your taxpayers, you need to notify every single property tax owner in that district. You need to have a public hearing, and local units of government, you need to take a recorded vote if you want to take more of their property tax money. So as we've seen property tax bills escalate pretty dramatically in many states across America, they've actually fallen in Utah. So those are a couple of just the big examples, but there's so many of things that Utah has done right to stay at number one now for 14 years in a row.
So have they had sort of a cultural agreement in the legislature that just has formed a pattern that they don't break out of? Sort of the opposite of California?
I think that's right. And it's a state that leaders come and go, and they take it as a citizen legislature, and there's no term limits there, for instance, but they have a culture of only serving a few terms in leadership and then passing the baton on to the next leader. And we've had some great ones over the years that I've had the pleasure to work with and have been very involved with Alec. But, you know, their culture has been exactly that. We don't spend more than we have. We live within our means. We're prudent with our finances. And we think innovatively about some of these problems that have really vexed so many of the states that have gone in a different direction.
This whole concept of truth in taxation seems to be gradually spreading. And I noticed that Governor Kelly in Kansas vetoed it last year, but then signed it into law. What changed?
That's a great question. I think this is really the gold standard of property tax reforms based on that Utah model that we were talking about. In Kansas, Democrat Governor Laura Kelly did veto this bill last year. It was the COVID shortened session. So I think she realized that the legislature was not going to come back and be able to override a veto. And then the margins even increased more this year, where there was only a handful of votes, Mr. Speaker, in both chambers in Kansas. So you had conservative and moderate Republicans, as well as many liberal Democrats, voting for this concept of accountability and transparency for property taxes. And I think she saw the writing on the wall that, quite frankly, her veto would have been overridden this year. And she would have looked very bad. This is a very popular reform. People hate property taxes, and for good reason, because they're very transparent. You know, you've cut that check, you realize the cost of local government, and this is a way to get at that cost. And I think she realized that there would be massive political consequences if she vetoed it. And let's not forget, she's up for re-election in 2022 in a very conservative state for a Democrat to hold office. So I think there had to be a little bit of a political calculus there.
From that perspective, how many states are there that should adopt it that have not yet adopted it?
Well, that's a good point. And there's only several states that have adopted it. It started in Utah and Tennessee and then just spread to Kansas. Right now, actually, are the senators in Lincoln, Nebraska are considering this. And I know Governor Ricketts is very excited to potentially sign it into law in Nebraska this year. But that gives a pretty wide playing field for other states that need to be thinking about this.
You know, Alec has always had a very innovative approach. I've been working with Alec, I think, since maybe 1981. And very often, through Alec meetings and Alec activities, good ideas spread from one state to another, and then become kind of a national pattern. So should those of us who care about better government be urging representatives in all of the other states to pass a bill similar to the Utah bill? And is the Utah bill basically about the same as the Kansas bill?
It's pretty similar, and now it is ALEC model legislation as well. And this is something, as you note correctly, that ALEC now has about 900 different model pieces of policy on its website that we look at best practices in free market government. And this is one of those that we're very proud of. And we just adopted it a couple of years ago, very close to the Kansas and the Utah model. And so it's something I think would be hugely beneficial for other states to address, because if you don't address this properly, then you run into the problem of what's happened in the states that have allowed property taxes to get out of control. And it leads to this out-migration. And this isn't just individual residential property. This is business property as well. And so for small businesses, this is a big deal in terms of where to invest in a state. And let me just say, if you make the mistake of not doing it right on property taxes, this has actually been one of the reasons why, let's say, if you look 50 years back, you had, instead of 9 states without a personal income tax like we have today, which is one of the best things a state can do, be more like Texas and Florida and Tennessee and not tax personal income. 50 years ago, we had 20 states roughly that did not have a personal income tax. And almost to a state, why they adopted a personal income tax was to try to buy down local property taxes, because local governments were probably run by progressives then in many cases. They overspent, they overtaxed. And then they came to the state level in a way to socialize out their big spending ways and ask for state dollars to buy down their local property tax burdens. And that's how you had states like New Jersey and Nebraska and Michigan and other states adopt income taxes, because they were looking to really correct this issue of local property taxes. They just went about it the wrong way. And ironically, fast forward to today, you have states like New Jersey that have, you know, high income, some of the highest income, highest sales tax in the country. And since they didn't really cap local government spending in this property tax problem, they still have some of the very highest property taxes today.
Have you seen any polling on the Truth in Taxation Act?
Yeah, I believe our friends at the Kansas Policy Institute, a great partner of ours that helped with this in Kansas, have done some polling, and it was very strong because, and it makes sense because you look at the most unpopular forms of taxes out there, and it's almost always gasoline taxes, it's almost always property taxes, and then the death tax. Those are generally, in public polling, always the three most hated taxes. And so anything to solve those kind of tax issues, I think will pull very well.
Let me ask you one other thing, which is, you see patterns here. I mean, you could almost have like an up arrow and a down arrow. And you could list sort of the series of things you do if you want to go down, and then list the series of things you do if you want to go up. And actually have a chart that says, here's a good way to measure how dumb your political system is. I've thought about writing a paper or a book that basically says, what did you think was going to happen? Where you look at, why don't we raise taxes enough that everybody leaves the state? Gee, I wonder why people are leaving the state.
That's a great point.
Or, I know Giuliani's anti-crime system worked, but I'm bored by it, and it has too many cops. So why don't I go back to what Dinkins was doing so badly and adopt every really stupid liberal idea? And then, oh, we just had 200% increase in shootings in New York in a year. Gosh, I wonder why that happened. I suspect you could do a little book on I Wonder Why That Happened, and just the stuff you already know from going around the country. It would be amazing, just sort of a voter's guide to really stupid politicians.
I love the idea. It sounds like we've found a partnership idea for a book there, Mr. Speaker, and I think it's a great one.
I'll tell you what, if you'll write it, we'll do the podcast and we'll help publicize it.
That's a deal. As Art Laffer likes to say, it's not rocket surgery. This is basic kind of common sense economics. And when you become less competitive, don't be surprised when businesses and individuals leave. And when you become more competitive, you're going to see the other side of that equation.
So let me ask you about one last thing, which is, share with people what ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, what does it really do, and why is it so important to the future of healthy policy in America?
Well, ALEC is really a one-of-a-kind organization, as you know well. We're going on 50 years of being here and standing for the key American principles of free markets, limited government, and federalism. And in fact, you may not remember this, I actually met you at my very first ALEC meeting nearly 15 years ago when I came on staff. And I've been a long timer because I believe so strongly in this mission. And that is, we reach state legislators, these people who are the innovators in these laboratories of democracy, and we work with them to talk about best practices, to develop both the original research and the thought leadership and the studies like this one in rich states, poor states, across all of our different policy areas, which if you look at a state committee structure, let's say in a state senate or a state house, every issue that they deal with on the fiscal and economic side, we have something at ALEC for them as a resource with our task forces where they can come and bring their best ideas and kind of share them with the rest of America, as well as then glean the best practices practices of other states, and not just the best practices, but of course, as you know, you can learn just as much about the bad apples in the barrel and learn from the mistakes of places like New York and New Jersey and Connecticut and Illinois and California. So it's the sharing of ideas, it's the free market principles, and it's the belief that the solutions to many of our problems that we talk about and you talk about on your show every week are not going to come from Washington. They're going to come from the states and the local units of government and from the private sector. And so having the voice of businesses, we're not afraid of talking to businesses and talking to those in the private sector. We think that's an important voice to have as part of the process. But it is a one-of-a-kind organization that I think is the future of America. It's the future of coming up with the policy solutions that will change and turn this country back around again. And it's just such a pleasure to be able to have worked with you and have you such an instrumental part in ALEC, both yourself and, of course, your former staff member and now our leader, good friend Lisa Nelson, who is our fearless leader at ALEC and taking so many of the things that she learned from you and your success in Washington and Congress as speaker and now bringing that to ALEC as well.
Well, and of course, Lisa was one of the key people in helping us write the contract with America and then helping us win a majority back in 1994 when she was running GOPEC. And so I have the greatest both affection and respect for what Lisa brings to the job, how committed she is, that she has put her lifetime work of trying to preserve and expand freedom in the United States. It's always great to work with her. As I said earlier, I've worked with ALEC. I think my first talk was in Chattanooga in 1981. When I was a sophomore congressman, and I have always thought ALEC had an amazingly important role to play nationwide. And I think that with this particular bill on truth and taxation, that you may have something really powerful that we'd like to follow up on. I really appreciate your dedication, the fact that you've studied this stuff so much. You're probably one of the two or three leading experts in the entire country on the differentiation between states that are succeeding and states that are failing. And I commend you for your continued methodical commitment to freedom.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. And I learned from the best. I perhaps as a very young individual in Michigan was a little too interested in politics and policy, but I remember those GOPAC training tapes and seeing all the things that you helped develop. And so it's just a pleasure to be with you today. And thank you for all of your partnership.
Thank you to my guest, Jonathan Williams. You can review ALEC's Rich States, Poor States, 14th edition on our show page at newtsworld.com. Newt's World is produced by Gingrich 360 and iHeartMedia. Our executive producer is Debbie Myers. Our producer is Garnsey Sloan, and our researcher is Rachel Peterson. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Pendley. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. Right now, listeners of Newt's World can sign up for my 3 free weekly columns at gingrich360.com/newsletter. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World.